listener production.
From the Inside with Peter Ricks.
This is part two of Peter's conversation with member of 70s group Hush and more recently composer, producer and sound designer Les Gock. For both Peter and Les, the growing success of Hush was a period of learning about the music business and about life on the road. It was an education on the job. In this episode, they look back at how they first met and some of the memorable and not so memorable moments of life inside a touring band in the 70s.
Yes, but Uncle Pete.
Yes.
Uncle Pete.
Uncle Les.
When we did first meet and you were the manager, and I've never met a manager before. I mean, you know, I'd heard of them, but I'd heard of Brian Epstein and people like that, you know.
My hero.
Yeah, and Brian your Epstein. Hero. And he had a suit. And you had the suit, and you came in. I thought, wow, you know, there must have been like management school or something, you know, that where these people come out of. I mean, you know,
no, that management school was me going on the road in the back of the transit van with you.
Yes, but before that, I met you, you were managing
that's
the band.
Right. So I had a mate who was a drummer in a band,
Cafiro.
Steve Cafiro, my beloved old friend, long gone, but one of the more interesting characters. He was also driver of number one in the Sydney consorting squad. And I was like 17 or 18 years. I'd just left high school. And so Stephen played in a band and he rang me one day and I was at uni but still working. And he announced that his car had broken down, and for those that ever knew Steve Cafiro, he became the drummer in a seminal Sydney punk band called X. But he always drove giant, thrushingly awful Cadillacs. So this car had broken down, as it always did, and can you come and pick me up because I've got a job tonight? So I went and picked him up, threw his drums in the back of my very small Fiat 124 coupe, that I loved at the time, and drove into Victoria Street in Darlinghurst and helped him unload it into the Maccabean Hall, having no idea where I was or what I was doing, and sat at the back of the room as he put the gear in, and then the band did a little sound check and I thought, well, I'm off now. And then the doors opened and about 1,500 gay men and women rushed into what was actually at the time called the Aquarius Club, which was totally illegal, and the drummer was a copper in the consorting squad, for Christ's sake. And I had previously, in order to get myself through uni and things, I used to run suburban dances on the odd occasion and get in a lot of trouble, but it was one of those things I liked doing and it came out of the back of school. So I'm sitting up the back and this bloke comes up next to me in a little white shirt and black trousers and a little bow tie and a glass eye and says, "G'day, mate, and what are you doing here?" And I explained, and he introduced himself as Bill Robinson, and he owned the club. But I mean, he just rented the venue and he had this committee, and so I sat there being the know-all that I was, and on night one proceeded to tell him that the place was thumping along. And all it was noise. It was like a nightclub with trestle tables, and you brought your own esky in with the booze, and Carlotta came through the door with six followers, and you know, there'd be a bunch of drag queens that get up and mime, "I'm leaving, Shirley Bassey's, I'm leaving on a jet plane." And here's Cafiro's band doing 30-minute sets till like 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was a much better gig than anything I'd ever run in a suburban hall. So I proceeded to tell him he needed acts, he needed stars, really, Bill, please. And so he says, "Well, who should I have?" And I'm saying, "Well, you know, Johnny Farnham, Colleen Hewitt, the Zoot," all from the time. So I'm 18 years old. I'm like, I'm a kid. And the next week I had a job running his club for him. And so I hunted down who I thought should be booked for the venue, and one of those bands was Hush. And so they'd turn up, and they were a giant hit, of course, five at the time, young 16, 17-year-old, very attractive boys, did very well in a gay club. And then out of the back of that, one day, Chris Nolan, the keyboard player, had a record contract offer from Warner's, and I was the only person because I was studying law at the time. And he said to me, well, you know, can you have a look at this? And lo and behold, suddenly the record contract meant Robin Jackson, the then guitar player, got pretty unhappy about leaving his beloved girlfriend and having to become a real musician. And whereas stars were in the eyes of everybody else, but everybody had a job. So they made Loud and Live, the album, and created the single Get the Feeling. We all thought it was all terrific and fun. And then all of a sudden, holy shit, it's a hit. What do we do now?
Going back to those days, here we were, we just had Peter, this is early days. We hadn't had a hit record yet. But we had a bit of a following, Sydney and so forth. And we got booked to be the support act to Gary Glitter. And this was the time, like, we were perfect. We out-glittered Glitter. And our costumes were so outrageous because he got the opera company to create these totally mad costumes, which we hadn't ever worn on stage before. This was our first chance. We got this gig that he got, which was a 2SM gig.
Moorpark.
Gary Glitter was headlining, and we were coming on before. And this was our big break. Like, we had, there's 10,000 people. This is our first big gig, really. First gig in front of 10,000 people. But there's no dressing rooms. So all we had was the back of the transit van. And so we said, okay, we can't just frock up and arrive in front of 10,000 people with all our gold lame. Yeah, we have to sort of, you know, arrive quietly, and then all of a sudden, bang, we're there, right? So he made us, we said, well, where do we get changed? He said, well, the back of the van. We said, the back of the transit van, you know, where all the equipment is. Yeah, well, bugger it, just go in there and get changed. So here we were. When the roller shutter doors from the transit van close, you can't see anything. You're in dark. And here we are trying to put on these costumes, which we've never put on before, the gold lame jumpsuits and all this sort of stuff. And I'm struggling to work out, what the hell? You know, we didn't know whether we had the clothes on backwards or what.
Complain. That's all they ever did.
Put it this way, when the roller shutter doors came out and we walked out of that van, all the bands backstage just went, oh my God, what the hell? And by the time we walked out, as soon as we walked out on stage, basically the audience went quiet. They just went, what is that? And I thought, great, perfect. I can now turn it up and let's go.
We used to have Les's wife, Margaret, and these are lovely, wonderful old stories, and it will never happen again. But she has never forgiven me for the invention of the Gypsy Caravan Tour of Australia.
Another brilliant idea by Peter Ricks.
May not have been one of my more successful ideas, but we ended up with the van again and the band. But the rules used to be no wives on the road. You're a touring pop rock group that needs to be seen as, you know, pop stars. Except we'll now go and do a summer tour through January in all the beach suburbs during the school holidays, up and down the coast of Australia, from particularly New South Wales. We did some in Victoria. And by the way, my other bright idea is to save money, because we're carrying all the wives and all the children, so we'll sleep in tents.
What a brilliant idea that was. What a brilliant idea. Here we are arriving at, you know, Caravan Park in, you know, out of whatever it is, some beach somewhere, and we've got these tents, and then, like, all these other people in the caravan park going, oh, isn't that Hush? That's how they're playing. That. Why are they? What are they doing there? What are they doing in these? And then here we are trying to hit stakes into the ground. You know,
and the odd night it rained as well. Oh my!
And
goodness.
We were there, and then, so all night there's all these people all coming around to the tent. I mean, it's
anyhow. I'd like to point out that the caravan section of the Gypsy Caravan Tour only lasted about 4 or 5 nights, and Margaret won.
Yeah.
Because in the end, we moved into hotel.
Can you imagine? Here we are, you know,
pop stars.
Pop band, pop stars. There's, you know, 3,000 of these people, probably mostly from the caravan park, coming to see us play, and we're all going into the community showers together.
Well, it was a good idea at the time, okay?
Yeah, great.
It seemed like it was going to make a lot of money.
How many of these did you go on?
I did. I was there.
Well, you're
I think
part
I was.
Of it.
I think I might have slept in the local motel there.
Oh yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
And the final one was, which was always the great moment, was that you would regularly play in venues, and the and in those days, the, it was there was no GST, no sort of money in the bank afterwards, no funds transfer. It was like cash in hand, and most of the promoters of these suburban jobs we'd play in, where they'd get Saturday night three times in a row, as Les talked about, you'd get 1,000 people minimally to these things. But there would be the odd dodgy guy that you knew already was going to be dodgy. So the great trick was we only ever had one road crew in those days. So you'd set the equipment, you'd have the drum kit on the stage, and the band would be in their full regalia backstage. And by then still didn't have the money. And sometimes you couldn't even find the guy who was actually in charge, but you knew who they were. So I'd have gone out the front to the where the box office was, and he wouldn't be there, and his girlfriend would say, oh, he's just out the back doing a bit of catering or whatever. So I'd send Keith or Les in their full costume just to walk across the front of the stage, on the stage, with all the house. I'd take the house lights out first and then just send them, and they'd wave, a little wave to the audience, and then leave again and nothing had happened. Well, of course, the place would go riotous. They're here. They're going to play. They're on. And as long as you stayed, they stayed backstage, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. At that stage, the place was like the floor would be bouncing up and down, and that's when the promoter would come back and hand me the money.
It was a Chuck Berry trick, really.
Well, I didn't care as long as, because you knew that if you ever left those venues,
you were never
going to see that money ever again. They were great days. God, you learned a lot.
Mm.
This is From the Inside with Peter Ricks, and this is part two of his conversation with member of 70s group Hush, and more recently, composer, producer, and sound designer, Les Gock. The years of touring and live performing also meant time with the other Aussie bands of the 70s. They look back on the connections made with bands such as AC/DC and on how Les began to get ready for life after being in a band.
So along the way, through those interesting 5-6 years, there were a lot of relationships built between the band, the Hushes, and a whole raft of Australian acts, bands that went on to extraordinary success. The Keystone Angels, when we went to South Australia and played those strange Wyalas and things.
Yeah.
What happened there? Was Doc in the band in those days?
Yeah, Doc was in the band, and they were a jug band, and the Brewsters were there. And I remember sort of, we always poke our heads around, have a look at the support act and to see what they're up to. And we thought, a jug band, oh my God, why would someone book a jug band, you know, to be our support act, you know? And they sort of did their thing, and they actually got a pretty good reaction. And I thought, oh, well, that's okay. You know, the gig is just to warm the place up. Anyway, we got on and we did our thing, and it went incredibly well. But the Keystone Angels were at the side of the stage. I could see them at the side of the stage, all kind of looking and studying, really. And I remember when we came off stage, they just, you know, Doc and everything came back and just said, oh, man, that was so great. That was so fantastic. You know, and they were talking amongst themselves as well, sort of saying things like, you know, we should be like that. We need to get Marshall amps. We need to get, like, guitars, get that big sound. And, you know, I remember saying something like, you know, that's a good idea. No, you should do that. I think the jug thing, I'm not sure that's going to go too far, you know.
So, well, 12 months later, they were in Sydney, signed to Albert's, and they were there. They weren't the Keystone Angels anymore.
No.
Do you remember playing the Horden Pavilion and the Festival Hall in Melbourne with AC/DC as the support act?
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember. Well, actually, I even go back further than that. I remember the first time we saw AC/DC, and we were you booked us into bizarrely a rehearsal theatre or something in Cronulla. It was a place in Cronulla, and it was like a theatre. And we were going there to rehearse.
Oh, it was the picture theatre that they turned into a gig venue.
Yeah, and we went there to rehearse.
It would have been cheap, Liz.
That's absolutely. I thought, God, we've had to drive halfway across the world just to,
Yeah.
Anyway, great. I remember we got there and there was some band rehearsing before us, and we thought, hurry up, guys, don't you know who we are, And it was AC/DC, and but it was with the original singer. And this is before they released Baby Please Don't Go. And in fact, I saw that they were rehearsing Baby Please Don't Go. And I thought, that guitar player, he's pretty good. Pretty, it's only short though,
I didn't realize till long after we'd sort of done those big shows with them that the two brothers were actually George Young's. It had never occurred to me that was the case, but my vivid memory is particularly the one in the Festival Hall in Melbourne, because we would get 6,000 people into those shows, and they were all underage, and so everybody was 14, 15 years, but Michael Browning, who had managed Billy Thorpe, was then managing AC/DC. The brothers had given him AC/DC because he was the big manager. And he's up above the stage with an AC/DC neon sign that was flashing away, and you're about to go on. So I've gone up and ripped the power out of the sign. The next thing, Browning and I are having a blue in the roof of the Festival Hall because I wasn't willing to have the AC/DC sign flashing as you guys went on.
Well, this is it. Look, there's all that era of bands. We all grew up at the same time. We all kind of, and we all experienced, we all went through the same sort of things. We had a camaraderie, and particularly with us in AC/DC, because we were literally all starting out at the same time. I remember we were just a bit ahead of them. So I remember we did the 2SM gigs at the Checkers. And again, AC/DC were on just before us. And I had to race out from... because I was a dispatch boy at George Patterson's then, because we all had jobs. And I had to race out at lunchtime and try and get people to cover me because I knew I'd be late coming back and I didn't want to get fired from my $40 a week job. And race down, get to to Checkers, and I remember I was waiting, and AC/DC and Angus was still playing before we got to go on. I thought, hurry up. I'm going to get back to work. And I thought, damn, that Angus guy's a good player. Anyway, whatever,
But they were always, you were still at work. Everybody in the band in those days was still at a job.
Yeah, we all had gigs because we,
Well, I don't think any of us really believed that it had longevity beyond, here's an album, isn't this doing okay?
Exactly. One other story I do remember, going back to the bands growing up together. Yeah. So, we became successful. We had a number one record. AC/DC were successful. They had, a few hits. None of them were number one, but that's a strong following. And we all stayed if there was a big gig and like the Melbourne Festival Hall gigs, I think, and perhaps during this one, we all stayed at the old Melbourne, which was now, I think it's now called the Commodore or something, but it was the old Melbourne Hotel, famous, and every band known to mankind would stay there. And one time, I think one of these Festival Hall shows which we did, we were there, Ted Mulry was there, AC/DC were there, and ABBA.
That's right.
Yeah, and ABBA. Mm. And so to get into the old Melbourne, you had to drive through this sea of...
And it was a courtyard, remember that?
Yeah, sea of 14-year-olds with, permanent, guards or whatever there, because in the old Melbourne was ABBA, AC/DC, Hush, Ted Mulry, and the rest, all turning the poor old Melbourne upside down. And then, you know, like the other thing that we used to do as a part of the thing was that because Hush weren't a big party-going outfit.
You were babies.
We were babies. But neither was Angus. See, Angus...
Yeah, but Bon Scott wasn't a baby.
Bon Scott wasn't. He was actually the elder, and so he went hard. Definitely he went hard. He and Phil. But that kind of left Angus kind of shag on a rock, you know, because all his mates are all out going pretty hard, and Angus didn't drink or... So he'd come and hang out with us and we'd play cards. We'd sit there, have a cup of tea and play cards. That was about as exciting as it got at the old Melbourne.
Yeah. I'm not going any further with those sorts of conversations. The one interesting thing about all of those performers, those bands that you've talked about, is the joining of the dots. The common bond was, because there was Skyhooks, if you remember, they arrived midway through your reign of terror, and Ted, who'd been there from the beginning, but AC/DC and the
JPY,
Angels,
yeah.
John Paul Young, every one of you was joined at the Ips, because on Saturday afternoon in the Elstonwick studios at the ABC, in the canteen, you'd all arrive... hungover as all hell from having to perform the night before somewhere in Australia, get up at the crack of dawn, get a plane to Melbourne because you couldn't afford not to be. That radio wasn't the only dominant force in those days, and that's the first time that television had a major impact.
The other camaraderie part of it, which is I've often thought about, you know, one of the things that united a lot of the people who from that era and probably the era before us was that it was very, very blue collar. To be in a band, you were unlikely to be tertiary educated, and unlikely to have come from, you know, one of the better suburbs and so forth. You were more likely to have been a factory worker, someone who worked on the roads or was a petty criminal. There was plenty of those and it was real rogues gallery. A lot of fun though, real rogues gallery. I kind of didn't fit in that well, but doesn't matter. I certainly came from a blue collar background, and so everyone had this sort of shared experience. And one of the difficult things about giving up or contemplating giving up being in a rock and roll band is, what are you going to go back to? And for most people, it doesn't really matter. I mean, a bad rock and roll band that hardly doesn't play that often and doesn't really earn that much money is still a better life than a lot of the kind of blue-collar existences they would have otherwise had to have gone back to, which is working in a factory, whatever. I know it sounds...
The talent piece is that no one that has any modicum of success at 22 or 23 ever wants to see their life beyond 30.
Mm.
There's no sense beyond that for virtually 100% of those guys.
Mm.
And in those days in particular, the road meant that in order to actually profit from your success as a recording artist, you had to go and work. And that's the world these days is a very changed place.
It's a very changed place. And that's why when we go back to what I did afterwards, I had a vision of, you know, what you could do afterwards. But for a lot of my contemporaries, there was no vision because there really wasn't any other choice you know, playing in a band is as good as it gets. Doesn't matter how bad that, you know, that how tough the touring is or anything. That's as good as it's ever going to get.
So we all have to understand and acknowledge that what you were a car was a car perv who saw a silver Alfa Romeo,
absolutely,
and said, "I aspire to that. What do I have to do? Who do I have to fuck to get that?"
Exactly, and I found out.
In part three of Peter Rix's conversation with Les Gock, they look at Les's personal reinvention. Being in a successful Australian band in the 70s didn't open as many doors as one would expect. Les needed to carve out his own path for the next phase of his life. It's a story that is equal parts about music and about one's own power to create personal change. A story that is just as relevant for today. That's next time on From the Inside. From the Inside with Peter Rix. Listener.